Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Wild Hour. Sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service of the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the October Money Changer when we come back. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, and private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? That bonds are the exact opposite to private property, that public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights, and permits are the exact opposite to private business? And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level, from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, Zoning and Planning, the IRS, and these swarms of government agents and agencies that are eating out your substance? Well, there's a lot that you can do, and the first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives that you have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package, and let me tell you more about what it is that you're not supposed to know about private business. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, I've been reviewing the October 2005 Money Changer. It's put out by Franklin Sanders of West Point, Tennessee. Post Office Box 178, West Point, Tennessee. The zip code 38486. The phone number there is 888-218-9226. Now, I recommend the Money Changer to all of my students, especially when we go through business school. If you're going to do business, or if you're going to do private business, particularly private business, you should be tuned in to the underground press. You should be aware of the international forecaster, the privateer, and the Money Changer. Three musts that I rely upon continually to keep me abreast of what's going on in the real world. And when I say the real world, I'm not talking about the consumer price index put out by the Bureau of Labor Statistics that tells me that inflation is running at 3% or 4%. Hell, I can look at the prices that are going up around me every day. I have never seen an inflated price of 3 or 4% in the last 2 years. Houses aren't inflating by 3 or 4%. They're inflating by 10, 15, and 20% a year. Gasoline isn't inflating at 3 or 4%. It's 30 or 40%. And so is everything else that you're buying out there. Now, the Money Changer is unique. It's put out 12 times a year. It's not as often as the International Forecaster, which comes out every week, or the Privateer, which comes out every 2 weeks. The Money Changer is a monthly publication in newsprint format. You can also get it over the Internet. You can just have it downloaded right on your website. But there's an article in here I wanted to share with you called Peak Oil. You've heard me talk about Peak Oil in the past, and I've said in the past, and I'll say it again, it doesn't make any difference for the average Joe Sixpack or Sally Housewife, if the world is running out of oil and there physically isn't as much oil underneath the crust of the earth as there was 10, 15, 20 years ago, or if the peak oil crisis is being manipulated by the major oil companies and governments of the world. If a shortage is there and the price is affected thereby, whether the physical oil is there or whether it's a manufactured political or economic crisis, it affects us the same way. Now, in 1950, I paid 27 cents a gallon for gas. By 1975, I was paying about 55 or 60 cents per gas. Then the price of gas went to $1, then to $2, and the last time I saw it was $3.25. And then it went down, and I think the other day they were selling gas here for $1.99 a gallon. That's what somebody told me, $1.99 a gallon. Now, unless you've got your own oil well, or unless you've got your own gas well, or unless you're making your own ethanol or something like that, if you're like I am, you pay whatever the price says you're going to pay on the marquee. It's the way life is. But we like to know, at least us businessmen like to know, where the bodies are buried, who's lying to us and why. And if I could understand that peak oil, if I could understand that price manipulation, if I could understand that war in Iraq, it'll help me in my business decisions down here when I go to buy this house from this guy for $50,000 and then I want to fix it up and sell it for $100. After all, that's where the money's at. It's in buying it for a dollar, selling it for $2, and you make it on that 2% markup. My wife was talking to a guy one time on the telephone, and he started to talk to her in some terms that were a little bit over her head, and she said, well, I don't know much about that, but I just work on a 2% principle, and I just know that if I buy it for a dollar and sell it for $2, I make 2%, and that's all I'm really interested in. Now, my wife went to school, and she can count real good, and so I kind of rely upon her on the 2% principle. Well, Franklin Sanders included an article this month in the Money Changer called Peak Oil Looking Mighty Peaked, and it's the third time I've seen this story. So let me share this story with you. It said, recently, a lot of information about peak oil has been floating my way. The peak oil theory holds that the world will soon, within the next 10 years, begin running out of oil. The decline will be so sudden and so sharp that it will ruin our modern way of life, resting as it does on cheap, plentiful oil. Now, are we really running out of oil? Well, the concept of peak oil is not new. In 1956, an oil scientist, Dr. M. King Hubert, theorized that national oil production would follow the production graph of an individual oil well, peaking and then declining sharply. Hubert then predicted that U.S. oil production would peak about 1970. Well, the peak came right on schedule, followed by a very sharp decline. Now, Hubert and others, building on his work, have since concluded that world oil production will peak sometime in the next few years. Now, enter the environmentalists. Back in the 1970s, the environmental movement expanded the we're running out of oil theme to embrace all natural resources. This, of course, played naturally into Americans' easily manipulated guilty consciences. We've all been trained to feel guilty over every mouthful of food. You know, we've heard, how can you leave those parsnips on your plate when thousands of children are starving to death in India? And to feel especially guilty over waste. You know, we've all heard that, look at all that water you're wasting. Why can't you take a bath in a quart of water like I do? Do you think we're made out of money? Now, all of this is complicated by the huge measure of truth that lives in the environmentalists' critique of modern industrial society. It is, in fact, wasteful. And it does, in fact, promote mindless, unthinking materialism. And among its mercenary tracts, industrialism also crushes human beings and human values. It promotes consumption by seducing greed. It chokes off thoughtful stewardship of the land and natural resources. It's a crazy way to live, and it produces abundant human misery. But this all remains true whether world oil supplies are peaking or not. And I have another problem with peak oil. I have seen several decades of disinformation published by the establishment to manipulate the masses by promoting false ideas, for instance. Although there are serious environmental concerns and hundreds of thousands of sincere environmentalists, the environmentalist industry, the great concentration of lavishly funded and publicized organizations, was created instantaneously by corporations and the foundations that they fund. But you may say, why would the very corporations that environmentalism is attacking fund their own enemy? Well, it's because these corporations and these environmental organizations are not enemies. Sure enough, when I began digging, I found out that the multi-billion dollar environmental industry was promoting policies that benefited who? Well, they promote the policies that benefit the oil corporations that they're attacking. The very same corporations that funded the environmentalism industry, and I think it's called creating and then controlling your own opposition. So here's an example. Corporation W owns vast timberlands in the Pacific Northwest. Up here in the Pacific Northwest is where most of the timber is logged off. It's logged off of public forests and then set aside for that purpose back in the early 1900s for the purpose of supplying cheap timber to Americans to build their homes and businesses. Now, environmentalism discovers that logging threatens rare spotted owls. So, legislation is enacted and logging is forbidden on public lands. This, then, creates a price increase of timber on private land, and the price soars. And Corporation W is well positioned to profit handsomely for many years into the future by logging the logs off of its private lands. Now, I'm sorry about all of you thousands of little people out there in the logging industry. The government will retrain you and find you new jobs operating computers. Now, of course, the many sincere people in the environmental movement never suspect how it is that these corporations and the environmental industry has exploited them. And now that's the way peak oil fits into this scenario. You see, along comes peak oil, which is a godsend to the environmentalists. It's also a godsend to the multinational oil corporations because it gives them an excuse to raise the price. So as the green scientist actually was recorded saying in one meeting in Oregon, he said, if the spotted owl didn't exist, we would have to invent it. So I'm sorry that my experience has left me suspicious. Hence, I read alertly an article by George Crispin, Oil Reserves Are Increasing. Crispin cites Eugene Island, an underground mountain off the Louisiana coast. It was discovered in 1972. The oil field began producing 15,000 barrels a day. Then gradually and very normally, it fell off of that 15,000 barrels a day and slowly went down to 4,000 barrels a day. Then in 1989, for some unexplained reason, it reversed itself and increased production to 13,000 barrels a day. Probably reserves have been increased from 60 million to 400 million barrels. Now, it's not supposed to work this way. You see, oil fields are supposed to be pumped dry and then stay dry. Now, there's a term here called abiotic oil fits better, A-B-I-O-T-I-C, abiotic oil. Now, enter an alternative theory. It's called abiotic oil. Peak oil rests entirely on a single presupposition, and that is that oil is a fossil fuel. Oil was created billions and billions of years ago by decaying organic matter and dead dinosaurs, and that only happened once. Abiotic oil, on the other hand, theorizes that oil is actually a renewable primordial syrup continually being manufactured by the earth under ultra-hot conditions and tremendous pressures. Oil is created in the ultra-hot regions at the bottom of the earth's mantle, then flows upward through the faults in the earth. Thus, oil is created not just once, but continuously. Russian and Ukrainian scientists originated the abiotic oil theory beginning in 1951. Now, I'm no petroleum scientist or engineer, certainly no expert, but it certainly seems to me that abiotic oil rests on much more than superficial assumptions. At least it rests on facts that as long as there are oil fields replenishing themselves in Eugene Island, or in the Gulf of Mexico, or Cook Inlet, or in Uzbekistan, or in Saudi Arabia, peak oil people have some explaining to do. Now, let's talk about conspiracy and disinformation. Now, I'm no conspiratorialist, but if I were, here's how my mind would turn over peak oil as a disinformation campaign. I want you to notice that I'm not drawing any conclusions, but rather I'm simply pointing out the holes in this theory that promises to stampede the whole world into this belief of peak oil. First of all, peak oil is the same threat that the environmental movement promoted back in the 1970s. Two, the environmental movement was created by the Establishment Foundation money as a part of a pinchers movement to build profits and more control for the establishment through their surrogate government. Three, Matthew Simmons has been running around the country promoting peak oil in his book Twilight in the Desert, The Coming Saudi Oil Shock and the World Economy, 2005, published by John Smiley and Sons. Four, Matthew Simmons belongs to the Atlantic Council and the Council on Foreign Relations, hence he belongs to the establishment. Five, peak oil promotes panic. In Paradise Lost, John Milton puts into the mouth of Satan the unfailing excuse of emergency. Thus, with necessity, the tyrant's plea, the fiend excused his devilish deed. The establishment government always justifies every expansion of its control with necessity. Six, the peak oil panic will result in more emergency control. Seven, the abiotic oil theory projects a completely different future to peak oil. Eight, the establishment and peak oil panicked members of the public ridicule abiotic oil. Nine, if abiotic oil theory is correct, there is no emergency and the establishment government doesn't augment its power. Ten, therefore, abiotic oil is probably the correct theory. 11, icing on the cake. Peak oil rests on an anti-biblical presupposition of the earth's great age, for instance, billions and billions of years old, as Carl Sagan used to intone sententiously. Abiotic oil does not. Well, there's the story. Now, I've seen that story. This is the third time I've run across it, and I thought, well, maybe there's something to it. I don't know if there is. I hope there is. If there's plenty of oil down there, then we don't have a problem. And if there isn't plenty of oil down there, then we probably do have a problem called peak oil. If in fact it's a resource like iron ore, you know, or coal, you go down to a coal mine and you start mining the coal, on day one, you've got 100% of it there. On day two, you have 100% of it there, less what you took out on day one. On day three, you still have 100% of it there, less what you took out on day one and day two. At some point in time, the coal mine runs out of coal, or the coal mine gets to a point where it costs more to get out the remaining coal than you can sell it for. Now, on these oil wells, it's my understanding that they can only get out of an oil well about 50 to 60% of the oil that's in the hole. Because after it gets down to a certain point, it costs more to get it out than the oil that's in there is worth. And there's a number of ways that they use to extend the life of those wells. They can pump steam down. That costs money. You can pump chemicals down. That costs money. And pretty soon, the amount that you're getting out for the cost of the chemicals and the steam that you're putting down doesn't equate, and so you finally abandon the well. I would like to point this out. Here in the United States, the other day, I saw some numbers that were pretty scary. After Hurricane Katrina, oil production in the United States has dropped to the same level that it was in 1943. So we're now pumping oil at the rate that we were back in the 1940s. Well, that's not very much oil compared to the amount of oil that we use in this country every year, 6 billion barrels, I believe it is, maybe a little more. So we need more and more oil because our oil consumption goes up by 5% a year. Now, 17% of the oil that we pump out of the ground is what we have to use to pump the oil out of the ground. In other words, if you pump 100 barrels out of the ground, it took 17 barrels of energy or oil to pump that 100 barrels out of the ground, so you only net 83. Then you can only get about 60% of the oil out of the ground, so that leaves 40% down there. And then when the environmentalists got involved in this thing over here, they left only the big corporations to pump oil. There used to be thousands of little stripper pumps. On the old oil wells, a guy would go in there and he'd let the oil well build up for about a week, and then he'd start it up and run it for a day or two, and he'd pump out 20, 30, 50 barrels. And then he'd shut it down. Sometimes those stripper wells would produce as little as a barrel of oil a day. But when you have thousands of them, the oil down in the ground, it gathers in a pool. It continues to drip. It's slow. You're not getting 15,000 barrels or 4,000 barrels a day. And that's all the big corporations are interested in, boys and girls, are the big numbers. And when these wells get down to where they're only producing a few hundred barrels, the big corporations, they don't want to mess with them, so they go on to greener pastures and leave it to some smaller well company to come in there and run it. I've had students here that have had some of those stripper wells. And then the government comes in and raises hell with those people. I don't know how much oil could be produced in this country, but it's a bunch. Off of all of the thousands of wells that have been producing in the past, which were stripper wells that have been shut down. So where does this lead us? It leads me to the conclusion that peak oil is a contrived oil shortage created by the oil companies through the environmental movement, assuaged by government for profit and gain by the multinational corporations. I don't know what we're going to do about it. I suppose when the price of oil goes to $6 a gallon, we'll be paying $6 a gallon. But right now, with oil at $3 a gallon, it's the same price as it was in 1950. Now, I wasn't complaining about the price of gasoline being 27 cents a gallon in 1950. We bought gasoline. We were making $1.75 an hour, and it cost us 30 cents a gallon for gas, and we paid the 30 cents a gallon for gas. Today, we make $15 or $20 an hour, and it costs us $3. To buy a gallon of gas. And the other day it dropped back down to $1.99. But listen, when this Hurricane Katrina hit, the price of gas was $1.59. It went up to $3 and now it dropped down to $2. We were complaining about the high price of gas at $1.60 a gallon. When it went to $3 and dropped down to $2 seems to be a bargain, doesn't it? And that's the methodology that has been used for many, many years. In order to raise the prices, you create a crisis, you raise the price, it makes everybody mad, then you lower the price to half what you raised it to, and everybody thinks you're a hero because the price has been cut in half. They talk about manipulation. Now, there's another article in here in the Money Changer. Remember, the Money Changer is published monthly by Franklin Sanders, Post Office Box 178, West Point, Tennessee, the zip code 38486. Telephone number to call to get prices and to get subscribed is 888-218-9226. I'm reviewing the October 2005 edition of the Money Changer. That number again, 888-218-9226. Now, this is an economics paper, and it's got an economics article in here, and I thought I'd share with you this thing, the question of deflation or inflation, the question that won't die. I get often asked, do you think that inflation is going to become rampant, or do you think that deflation is coming on the scene? So, for myself, I have prepared for both eventualities. I prefer deflation in an economic crisis to inflation. But I suspect, according to what the Federal Reserve has been publishing over the last couple of years and the president's appointment of Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the New York Fed, this is Helicopter Ben. Now, Helicopter Ben was speaking a couple of years ago, and he said, to prevent deflation, if necessary, we will drop $100 bills out of helicopters. Well, as a businessman, that sends me a signal. And it's not a good signal. But Ben Bernanke and Alan Greenspan and the budget deficits and the national debt and, you know, the economic picture that I see, that I watch the Dow Jones Industrial Average and I watch the Pledge Protection Team, the price of gold and the price of silver, and I'm a businessman, and it sends me a signal, and I react to those signals. Now, different businessmen react to the very same signals that I'm receiving in a different way. It's not an exact science. Economics, as far as I can tell, is an art. Some people make money and some people don't. Now, I looked into the Bible and I saw that there were 15 economic laws. And so I thought, I wonder if the creator of the universe knows something about economics, knows something about business that George Gordon doesn't know. After all, this God fellow, he says that he's been here forever. He says, I'm without beginning and I'm without end. Now, if he's without beginning, he has been here for a long time. I haven't. I got here relatively recently. I just showed up on the scene about 1939, and for the first 20 years, I didn't do a whole lot in business. I got started in business when I was 11 years old with a paper route. I learned business and business principles from some old-timers, old-timers that could remember gold and silver coin, old-timers that remembered the Great Depression. And they told me some things, and of course, that impressed me as a young boy. At age 15, I had $5,000 in the bank, paying me 2.5% interest at Bank of America. Not very many 15-year-old kids have $5,000. I did. I didn't think it was any great accomplishment. I learned how to save money. I learned how to invest it. I learned how to make it. I also experienced some losses. I know how to lose money. And from that experience, I take a look at the signals that I see out in the marketplace, and I react to those market signals, and I make decisions. Now, so far, I'm not disappointed with the decisions that I've made. And let me give you your reminder at the midway point, and we'll come back and let's take a look at deflation or inflation from Franklin Sanders' point of view. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. That's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our website at georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, on the question of deflation or inflation, the question that won't die, to make clear the point of the argument which seldom is made clear, remember that deflation means only a decrease in the money supply, and that inflation means only an increase in the money supply. Inflation is not rising prices, and deflation is not falling prices, although increases or decreases in the money supply can result in price changes. If you think of inflation as rising prices or deflation as falling prices, you will never understand anything economic or monetary. It's like trying to talk about elephants while working with the definition of an elephant as a motorized three-wheeled cart prone to flip over under acceleration. Now, personally, I have rejected the deflation hypothesis. It's not that deflation is not deadly, but that it is too deadly. Back in the 1930s, when deflation took hold, nothing could stop it. All the inflating that the Roosevelt administration could do only flopped in the 1937-38 recession. All of our money is borrowed into circulation. So when debt begins collapsing like dominoes, it automatically causes deflation. The money supply's basis evaporates, and worse yet, lenders are afraid to lend, and borrowers are afraid to borrow. And without lenders and borrowers, money cannot come into existence in our system today. Now, deadly deflation meets inflation and blarney. Precisely because deflation is so deadly, over the past 70 years or so, our rulers, the establishment, have put into place all sorts of automatic stabilizers. They work hard to turn on the government spending sprinkler automatically at the first whiff of deflation, long before any deflation can lock its jaws on the economy. Moreover, the establishment government and Fed flunkies scan the financial system continuously to anticipate any hint of collapse or crisis. What Alan Greenspan euphemistically terms cascading cross defaults. Now, despicable as they are, the establishment is neither stupid nor are they incompetent when it comes to manipulating the system in their favor, and they are becoming more proactive every day. Just witness the plunge protection team. Now, the establishment's standard, and remember, it's their only standard, it is the only cure for a financial panic, is inflation and blarney. Inflation and BS. Blarney happens when Alan Greenspan appears on TV, blinking behind his Coke bottle bottom glasses, and then he mumbles for the sheep some profound but totally unintelligible assurances that the financial system is indeed sound as a dollar. So depending on the seriousness of the crisis, this will be followed by a parade of assorted Treasury undersecretaries for blarney, and then the President of the United States, just to make sure that everybody understands what it is that he's supposed to know. Blarney is standing in front of a herd of stampeding cows, waving a shirt and yelling to turn them. Sounds crazy, but it usually works. Inflation is the only effective crisis-fighting weapon that the establishment has. Inflation is all they have. Therefore, in every crisis, they will flood the system with liquidity. Since want of liquidity defines every financial crisis, it's a fairly adequate point. It's a fairly adequate weapon. And precisely because the establishment understands that they're powerless against deflation, they have built in manifold automatic money supply inflators. They understand that they hold on to power only as long as they inflate the currency. Therefore, political necessity decrees that in each and every economic crisis, in good times or bad, the establishment will inflate the currency. They will, and they must inflate if debt starts collapsing, and they will inflate even if it destroys the dollar's value. They care absolutely nothing for the dollar's value, nothing, nothing, nothing. Only for holding on to power, 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 do they care. Now here's the paradox. Paradoxically, inflation causes depression, even though the economists teach that only deflation causes depression. The textbooks tell us that a little inflation can stimulate an economy, which is total hogwash. It's a lie. It's totally untrue. And they seldom mention hyperinflation at all. Inflation always results in the economic conditions that we call depression. But we don't like to use the word depression, so we use the word recession. And we don't like the word recession, so we called it a mild recession or a medium recession or a deep recession, but we avoid the word depression at all costs. That is constricted economic activity and psychological depression in all market participants. A depression creates a psychological depression in all of us. We don't want to hear the word depression. The worse the inflation gets, however, the more that it dislocates the economy. This is why the inevitable happens. So why is that inevitable? Well, because inflation causes the most useful economic forecasting tools, called prices, to send false signals. And that especially applies to the price of money. And the price of money is expressed in interest rates. Artificially low interest rates fool businessmen into borrowing more money because low interest rates appear to predict that more demand is on the horizon in the future. And when the future arrives, they find the signal was false and they can't service their debt and they end up in bankruptcy and failure. Inflations, which at first appear to stimulate the economy, always end in hyperinflationary depressions. The central bank churns out money as fast as it can, but economic conditions get slower and slower. Now, these hyperinflationary depressions can occur in 1 to 3 years, or in some cases, decades, or occasionally, it may take 70, 80, 90, or 100 years, as in the case of the United States. It is certainly possible, in fact, inevitable, that our present inflation will end in a hyperinflationary depression, need not to mention a war in Iraq. Constraints and constraints that the establishment to respond to every crisis and downturn results in more inflation. Now, 2005 is not the same as 1935. And whoever overlooks this political necessity will miss the point and forecast a deflationary depression. And why is that? Because they analogize from the 1930s events, and then they assume that the same events will unfold today in the 21st century. However, they overlook first this political necessity and second structural changes in the financial and monetary systems since the 1930s. When the Depression began back in the 1930s, banks worked under a 35% reserve requirement. Today, these same banks work under a 2/3 of 1% reserve requirement. In the 1930s, the automatic stabilizers didn't exist. Today, the engine of inflation has been installed throughout government and central bank policy and central bank structure. At the Great Depression's outset, banks still held gold as reserves, and U.S. paper money was redeemable in silver and gold. Today, the banks hold absolutely no objectively valued reserves of any kind, much less gold or silver. And the money today is created totally out of thin air. It is borrowed into existence. Now, when you're creating money out of thin air, to create more, you only need to find more air. An example of that came from the recently rolled FEMA head, Michael D. Brown. FEMA, he announced, would issue debit cards worth $2,000 each to 319,000 Katrina victims. That was a total of $638 million. Now, today, the rate of inflation no longer depends on slothful printing presses. Today's government can hand out debt cards anytime the need arises. So listen to your contradictors. Now, having confessed that I expect the ultimate outcome to be hyperinflationary depression, I still eagerly seek out contradictory opinions so that I can evaluate my position from time to time. After all, I'll never learn anything from people who are only talking or taking my position. I'd rather listen to the opposing opinions, those who disagree with me, because maybe they found something that I missed. Maybe I'm wrong. Hence, I gladly read Deflation's Revenge on Illusory Wealth by Rick Ackerman. Now, in an earlier article, Mr. Ackerman had written that a precipitous deflation could inhibit the price of gold from reaching stratospheric heights. He argues, "My reservations about gold are rooted in the fear that we will experience an actual plunge rather than a gradual slide into economic winter." I use the word precipitous, and I mean it quite literally. To put it as bluntly as I can, I believe that there is a more than negligible chance that we will awaken one morning to a financial cataclysm that has left us all flat broke, meaning, for one, bereft of liquid savings that could conceivably be exchanged for bullion, goods, or services. Now, that's Mr. Ackerman's argument in a nutshell. The crisis will unfold before the establishment can flood the market with Blarney and liquidity. Now, I will cheerfully admit that this chance, in fact, exists. However, I would counter that all of the establishment's efforts are bent and trained toward containing a crisis and preventing precisely what it is that Mr. Ackerman fears most. Responding to the Asian monetary crisis of the summer of 1997 and the LTCM crisis of August of 1998, the Council on Foreign Relations, spurred on by President Bill Clinton himself, set up a financial vulnerabilities project. The Council on Foreign Relations virtually is the American establishment. Over the next 18 months, they held meetings to address the possibility of cascading cross defaults and how they would respond. They simulated a crisis by closeting teams to role-play their way through a model financial crisis. Remember, too, the Working Group on Financial Markets, the so-called Plunge Protection Team, the automatic stabilizer had already been installed in 1987, and without doubt is actively manipulating markets today, forestalling every downdraft lest it grow into a tornado. Now, FEMA's response to Hurricane Katrina, mentioned earlier, handing out debit cards with $2,000 each, furnishes a foretaste of how the establishment will react to financial crisis in the future. I wouldn't be surprised to see them put $5,000 in every bank account in the country. If they were desperate enough, they would do it. Which proves my point. Mr. Bush just appointed helicopter Ben Bernanke to succeed inflation fighter Alan Greenspan as the next Fed chairman, and helicopter Ben got his nickname from the November 2002 speech that he gave to quiet deflation fears, in which he intimated that the Federal Reserve, if need be, would drop money out of helicopters to fight deflation. So while I recognize that Mr. Ackerman's fears are valid, the establishment's whole weight and inflationary power will be brought to bear on any financial crisis, whether sudden collapse or slow burn. I think they will prevail, although their victory will resemble a snake eating his own tail. The inflation that they employ against the crisis will become hyperinflation and collapse and burn. Now that should give silver and gold owners plenty of time to enjoy a staggering bull market. Franklin Sanders. So let me give you a few thoughts on this from my perspective. I couldn't agree with Franklin anymore. I see the same story, I read the same tea leaves, and I've come to the same conclusion, that if there's any way that we can avoid deflation like we saw in the 1930s, we're going to do it. All right, so I'm prepared for hyperinflation. So I spent some time looking at what hyperinflation does to economies in Brazil, Argentina, Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador. I mean, the banana republics have gone through hyperinflation in the past. In fact, so has the United States of America. In 1783, the continental currency collapsed. It happened in Germany in 1923, so it isn't something that's new. It's very simple. Let's suppose that today you're out working and you're making $20 an hour. And you know that that $20, that every hour you work, will buy 20 loaves of hillbilly bread at $1 a loaf. So you work 8 hours at $20 an hour, you make $160 a day. Now you have to take your deductions out of that. So by the time you get all through with your unemployment insurance and workman's compensation and income tax and health deductions and all the rest, you net $100. That's 100 loaves of hillbilly bread a day. Net, net, net. So you save your money for 10 days and you put it in the bank. And you hope to get 4% interest on your money, so that your $100 a day for 10 days, your $1,000 produces $40. So at the end of the year, you'll have 1,040 loaves of bread. You will forego spending the $1,000 today on 1,000 loaves of bread. You'll put it in the bank and hope to get 1,040. Now, inflation is going on all around us. The government tells us officially it's 4.7%. So at the end of the year, your 1,040 loaves that you expected aren't going to materialize because prices went up by 4.7%. So a loaf of hillbilly bread now costs $1.04 or $1.05 a loaf. That's in the best case scenario. You didn't gain anything, but you didn't lose anything. Your interest just about offsets the inflation. But in the real world of hyperinflation, the price of hillbilly bread will go from $1 to $2 tomorrow, and $2 to $4, and $4 to $8, and $8 to $16. So if you've got $1,000 in the bank, and you go down to buy hillbilly bread, it could be $16 a loaf, which means that you're not going to get 1,000 loaves of bread, are you? You're going to get 62 loaves. So the signal that that sends to us businessmen out here is that we don't want to hold dollar-denominated assets. And I haven't been holding dollar-denominated assets for many, many years, nor have I recommended them. And I don't recommend that anybody else hold dollar-denominated assets either. I recommend that you hold the hillbilly bread. Now you're going to argue, yeah, but if I bought 100 loaves of hillbilly bread, it would get stale. That's true. But if you were to buy 100 pounds of wheat, you could buy the 100 pounds of wheat for $25. You could buy the rest of the ingredients for $25, and those ingredients will keep forever, properly stored. They took wheat out of the pyramids that was 3,000 years old, and it still sprouted. So I'm going to use my wheat and my other ingredients, the salt and the sugar and the other things, that don't spoil. I take my $1,000 and I buy the goods today that I'm going to use tomorrow. And I've told people for years, I think you should have a 4-year supply of food on hand, or you should be like Franklin Sanders, you should have your own farm where you produce your own food. I do, he does. But I still have a 4-year supply, and the reason that I advocate that 4-year supply, and especially for you people living in the city with jobs, what makes you believe that the bread is going to be in the Walmart store when you walk in there with your $1,000 to buy it? Did you know that 50% of the food that we consume in the United States, it's over 50% now, comes into our country as imports from overseas? French wine, Holland, Dutch cheese, you know, German beer. I mean, you know, and you're sitting there saying, well, when we buy potatoes, how are your potatoes? Your grapes come from Chile. Your berries from Guatemala. Your Brussels sprouts come from, you know, from Mexico. Your tomatoes come from Mexico. No, boys and girls, it's good to have some gold and silver, and I think that wealth should be stored in gold and silver, but after you have a four-year supply of food, is your house bought and paid for? Do you have a free and clear house? How are you going to make the mortgage payments? What makes you believe that you're going to be employed during a hyperinflation when in Argentina the unemployment rate hit 62% when they went through their economic meltdown in 2001? And their currency collapsed and they went into hyperinflation. Then they went on to COD and they couldn't import things because they had to pay for them cash on delivery. You know, there are some serious economic problems coming up, and that's why I suggest that you subscribe to the International Forecaster, the Privateer, and the Money Changer. It'll keep your mind honed on the real issues that are going on around us, because government is going to deflect our attention. And when they deflect our attention, they're going to take away from you your interest deduction allowance on your mortgage payments. That's coming next. President Bush doesn't want to raise your taxes, so he's going to take away one of your very important deductions. And before they do that, they will deflect your attention with a war with Syria or a crisis with Venezuela or. And it's during these deflections of your attention that these economic moves are made. And the people who identify these moves are the people that publish the Money Changer, the Privateer, or the International Forecaster. So since I'm reviewing the Money Changer, let me give you the name and number again. Remember, that's Franklin Sanders, the Money Changer, P.O. Box 178, West Point, Tennessee, 38486. Or just call direct and get the details. It's 888-218-9226. Again, that's 888-218-9226. All right, I'm about out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and text. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So thanks for listening, and until then, good night, friends.